After dinner, Amanda and Devlin went for a walk in the springtime twilight, up to Bancroft Tower. It wasn't until they were alone in the tower room, with the damper switched on and the windows photo-screened, that Amanda spoke. "What will you do?" she asked. Devlin didn't need the context filled in for him. It was the only thing he'd been thinking of since Caitlin informed the group of the nature of the school's new counselor. Now he took a deep breath, let it out slowly, and said, "I think I can handle her." Amanda gave him a speculative look. "You think?" "I've had some training in surface thought control. If she really is a commercial telepath, she's a P5. She can't do a deep scan without effort. And it takes a deep scan to uncover a telepath if he can keep from giving himself away with his surface thoughts." "And you think you can?" "I know I can," Devlin replied, without a trace of his usual self-deprecation. "What do you think my dumb Englishman routine is for?" Amanda nodded. "Understood," she said. "Suppose she isn't really a P5. Devlin considered this, then shook his head. "They wouldn't waste a psychop on a job like this. If they had a clear target, maybe, but not the way they're doing it. And anyway, if Miss Leclerc were a psychop, I guarantee you she'd be a more competent interrogator than that." "I see. Even so, why take the risk of going at all?" "Not going would seem suspicious. If they're hunting a blip, they'll be especially curious about anyone who comes up with a reason not to meet with her. That's why I've had this training, because it's a standard tactic. They've had a tip that there's a blip on campus, and now they're fishing." "You seem very calm about it all," observed Amanda. Devlin chuckled. "That's just the outside. Inside, I'm screaming in terror." "We could leave. Go back to Gamelon, or to wherever the Vengeance is patrolling." Devlin shook his head. "No. No, if they're playing this game, they don't have a very solid lead. Just a rumor, probably. If she doesn't get anything, they'll assume it was a false alarm and give up. I won't abandon everything just because they're sniffing around. I may be a coward, but I have my pride." Amanda would have commented, but it would have been a major pot kettle case, so she let it pass, merely nodding. "What about you?" inquired Devlin. "You have an appointment with her as well." "I am a Gamelon soldier," Amanda replied grimly. "We do not divulge information to the enemy." Devlin looked her in the eye, then smiled and took her hands. "We'll get through this," he thought. "Of course," she replied. Over the next 2 days, Miss Leclerc left 4 voice messages for Caitlin and sent her 3 email messages, all entreating her to please make a follow-up appointment to discuss whatever it is you think I did to offend you. Caitlin deleted them all with a series of derisive snorts. Utina's was the first appointment after Kate's, and despite her assertion to the contrary, she did keep it, but only to stand in the doorway of the counselor's office and tell her, "You leave my roommate alone, and while you're at it, stay away from me, too." Then she turned, ignoring the counselor's protest, and left Boynton Hall at a brisk, angry walk. By Martine Leclerc's standards, her meeting with Devlin Carter on Friday morning was an outright disaster. He knocked over his chair, not out of nervousness, but just sheer clumsiness, and then, as he was apologizing profusely and picking it up, he managed to knock over her desk. Once everything had somehow gotten rearranged back into its proper order and Carter was installed in his chair, he proceeded to bubble inanely for the full 20 minutes about things of absolutely no consequence. Oh, he was friendly enough. A very cheerful, personable, eminently likable fellow. But there was no more inside his head than you would find in an exhausted aqualung tank. He didn't have any problems to unburden himself of, because he was too dense to be troubled by anything. Still, despite the fact that he had nothing interesting to say, Carter seemed quite willing to talk. He had to be reminded twice that his time was limited, until she finally had to all but push him, reiterating his apologies for his earlier clumsiness and saying several times what a treat meeting her had been out the door. It was with something akin to relief that Miss LeClerc closed the door behind him, secure in the knowledge that he would never be back. Moose McEachern asserted grumpily that his only problem was the campus crusade for Calidor. The two missionaries of theirs he'd handed into the tender care of Jacron had never returned, but the crusade had others, and they just were not giving up. Miss LeClerc gave him the standard, slightly patronizing lecture on religious tolerance, and sent him on his way. Her own commitment to religious tolerance was to be tested by her next visitor from that particular peer group, because Azeline de Vere Natoshkin was very distracted on Monday afternoon. It seemed that there was a major observance coming up in the next couple of days, with whose preparations the Dantrovian was quite absorbed. Miss LeClerc had never seen a Dantrovian before, and hadn't had time to do any research, so she was utterly unfamiliar with the religion in question. The imagery that met her mind's eye when she made her standard unauthorized scan came thus as a tremendous surprise. "Miss LeClerc, are you all right?" asked Azeline, as the counselor suddenly blushed and pushed herself back in her chair a little. "You look a little feverish."
Azeline, I'm fine," said Miss LeClerc as she fished out a handkerchief to mop her suddenly sweat-daubed forehead. "You were saying?"
"Oh," said Azeline, comprehending. "Radiating a little, was I? I'm sorry. I can't help it. It's always worst in April. Springtime light conditions, you know? Bumps my core and estrophine levels through the roof. Sometimes I just don't know what to do with myself." She wriggled a little in her chair. "That's not really anything you can help me with, though, huh?"
This happens to you every year?"
"Yep, sometimes more than once. Springtime on my part of Dantrov starts in July on the standard calendar, see?"
"Ah, have you considered perhaps a medical solution?"
"To what? It's a perfectly natural condition. We're designed this way for a reason, you know. Evolution doesn't make mistakes." She grinned. "I don't need drugs, I just need a good... well... I guess it does seem sort of odd to a human. Why don't I just go?"
Though she felt that she was, perhaps, doing less than her therapeutic duty, Miss LeClerc nevertheless found herself inclined to agree. Compared to Azeline, the cool composure of her roommate, Amanda Dessler, came as a positive relief, even if her attitude wasn't particularly accommodating.
"I'm here merely as a courtesy," Amanda informed her. "Truth be told, I have grave reservations as to your ability to offer me counsel in any meaningful fashion."
"Oh?" said Miss LeClerc. "And why is that?"
"When I went home for the spring interval," said Amanda matter-of-factly, "my younger sister made 4 separate attempts on my life, one of which, as you can see, was very nearly successful." She blinked her good eye coolly at the counselor and added, "What do your talents and training say to that?" Miki Kaworu was earnest, sincere, and utterly unhelpful. Apart from his peculiar, somewhat disconcerting habit of timing things with a stopwatch, he seemed a perfectly well-adjusted young man. He smoothly and artlessly deflected questions about his fellow refugees from the Rim, pleasantly but finally informing the counselor that questions about them should be directed to them, and that if, for example, Utnatenja refused to talk to her, that was regrettable, but not Miki Kaworu's problem. Miss LeClerc got nothing useful from him, and when she sent him on his way, she had a maddeningly catchy snippet of some unidentified piece of Russian-sounding classical music stuck in her head, where it would remain for the rest of the day. The Barsavian Scrang in Galaxy House, whose name Miss LeClerc couldn't come even close to pronouncing, even mentally,
asserted that he had no problems worth noting, and that, in any case, the way of his people was to work through their own problems, not burden others with them. He was quite civil, but would not be moved by the here-to-serve speech. Ditto the freespacer, who, like all of his kind, fairly radiated mistrust. Miss Leclerc was just as happy to have him out of her office as he was to leave. She wasn't eager to attempt working past a cultural indoctrination that so thoroughly prejudiced its victims against telepaths, as her education, training, and personal experience had all shown her the freespacer way of life did. Wakaba Shinohara wasn't quite a student. She was enrolled for the fall semester and auditing the spring classes, but not receiving credit for them, and the student database listed no residence for her. Nevertheless, she was on the Institute's books and a member of a campus club, so she'd received an appointment like everybody else. On the afternoon of Wednesday, April 6th, she reported promptly at 4, dressed in the oddest outfit Miss Leclerc had seen in some time, and, like the Tenjo girl and the Scrang had been, carrying a sword. "I'm uncomfortable with weapons," Miss Leclerc told her after the introductions. "Would you please put your sword over by the door?" Wakaba looked, gauging the distance from the desk to the door, then shook her head and replied pleasantly, "Sorry, no. In an emergency, I couldn't get to it fast enough from way over here. I can put it under my chair if you like." The counselor blinked, looking consternated. Like most nominal authority figures, she'd phrased the instruction as a request, but hadn't expected it to be treated as one, then decided she supposed that would be all right. Wakaba removed the katana from her belt and stowed it under her chair, then slouched easily in the chair, folded her arms across her brass-buttoned chest, and said conversationally, "So, what can I do for you?"
I think that's my line, Wakaba. May I call you Wakaba?"
"Sure, it's my name," replied Wakaba agreeably.
"I don't need any help right now, thanks." "According to your file, you're another of our refugees from the Outer Rim. I'm told what happened to you all there was quite traumatic."
She smiled sympathetically.
"Indeed, it must have been. I haven't been able to get either of the others I've met with so far to talk about it. Miss Tencho refused outright to see me."
Wakaba nodded.
"Yeah, I know."
"Are you a friend of hers?"
"Oh, yeah. Back at Otori Academy, we used to be best friends."
"Used to be? You're not any longer?"
"Nah, we had kind of a falling out before Utena left the Academy. We patched it up. I'm here, after all. But nowadays I come in second. Maybe third," she added with a private little grin that the counselor couldn't fathom.
"Would you mind telling me what caused the falling out?" Wakaba shrugged.
"There was a guy involved," she said. "Isn't that always the way?"
"This was back at your old school?"
"Yeah, he was one of the administrators at the academy. You don't know him."
Wakaba's smile took on another curious dimension as she added, "Which is a shame, really. I think you're just his type." Miss Leclerc felt the color rising in her cheeks. Something about the look in Wakaba's eyes as she said that made the counselor feel very strange. She cleared her throat and said,
"Doesn't it bother you that you've made amends, but yet you're not her best friend any longer?"
"Not really," Wakaba replied easily. "Nothing lasts forever. Anyway, we're as close now as we always were. It's just that there's someone now she's even closer to. And that's cool."
"This is all very interesting," said Miss Leclerc. "She seems like a remarkable person to command such loyalty from her friends."
"Oh, she's that all right."
"I wish I could talk with her, as I'm doing with you," said the counselor sadly. "She refuses to meet with me, you know. Won't even return my emails."
Wakaba nodded.
"I know."
"Do you know why she would take that attitude?"
The auburn-haired duelist fiddled with one of the dummy buttons on her double-breasted jacket for a moment, a thoughtful look on her face. Then she said, in a perfectly conversational tone,
"Well, this is just a shot in the dark, you understand, but I'd say it's probably because you violated her best friend.
Miss Leclerc flushed. Well, really, Miss Shinohara, she said in a shocked, angry tone. I don't know what that girl thinks I did, but I assure you.
Wakaba held up a hand, palm outward, and said, still without heat or unpleasantness, Save it. We're through here. She collected her sword, got up, and returned the blade to its place on her belt.
Utena Tenjo earns her friend's loyalty with her own loyalty to them, she informed the counselor. Unless Kate forgives you, she'll never talk to you. Ever. So if I were you, I wouldn't waste my time trying to contact either one of them, and I'd quit fishing for information about them from their other friends, because it's not going to get you anything but a whole boatload of enemies.
She gave Miss Leclerc a perfunctory bow, then added pleasantly, That's it. End of speech. Nice meeting you.
Miss Leclerc sat silently fuming for several seconds before turning to compose her report.
I got you off the hook with Miss LeCue this afternoon, Wakaba noted to Utena at dinner.
You're welcome.
Off the hook? Said Utena, looking confused.
Yeah, it was pretty obvious she was suspicious of something after you refused to talk to her, so I spelled it out all nice and neat for her.
Wakaba grinned.
Of course, she probably thinks you and Kate are lovers now, but you can't make an omelet.
Utena choked on a sip of orange juice, only narrowly stopping herself from repainting Sionji's shirt front with it. Then she got it down, coughed, and gave Wakaba a look that combined disbelief, amusement, and reproof.
That's choke-worthy? Said Kate, sounding offended.
Gee, thanks.
Utena turned to her, saw the grin that said she was kidding, left it unaddressed, and turned back to Wakaba.
What did you say to her?
Nothing that isn't true, Wakaba insisted. Just that you're really loyal to the people you love, and you won't talk to her because of what she did to Kate, and if she knows what's good for her, she'll quit trying to dig information about you out of the rest of us. Not that I think that'll do any good, of course. So remember, everybody, she added cheerfully, Stonewall her if she asks about Utena or Kate.
The next member of that social circle to come up on the counselor's calendar was another of the Sephirian refugees, Juriari Sugaba, who lived on the room across the hall from Kate Hutchins and Utena Tenjo. Miss Leclerc knew she would have trouble with this one the moment she entered the office. Juri was tall, cool, graceful, and she took her seat and crossed her long, slim legs with smooth elegance. Everything about her manner said that here was a person with tremendous confidence and the material to back it, or a very, very good bluffer. Miss Leclerc decided to try a different tack with this one. After very civil salutations, she referred to Juri's file, for effect, made the usual observation about the fact that she, like four others at the Institute, had come to them from a now-defunct school on a raider-ravaged world in the Outer Rim territories. Then, rather than asking how she was finding the adjustment, the counselor inquired, What do you miss most about your old school?
Juri didn't seem terribly surprised by the question. She thought about it for a moment, then replied,
Not much in the final analysis. The campus was prettier. Some of the facilities superior. The administration was much more difficult to deal with, however. The redhead added with a dry little smile that spoke of a hidden context.
Your schoolmate, Miss Shinohara, mentioned that she and Miss Tenjo had a falling out over an involvement with one of the administrators, Miss Leclerc noted. Was such behavior common at Otori Academy?
Regrettably, yes, Juri replied. The deputy chairman was only in his 20s, and was sometimes known to lack discretion.
Oh, my, said Miss Leclerc, scandalized. Did he ever make advances toward you?
Is this inquiry relevant in some subtle fashion which I have clumsily overlooked? Asked Juri calmly.
I'm just trying to establish a background, understand where you five are coming from.
"It's better if you don't try too hard," said Jurian. Her tone was not harsh, but it didn't invite debate. Miss Leclerc abandoned the thread and snatched at a new one. "I understand you're rooming with our robotic student, R. Dorothy Wainwright."
"That's correct."
"How do you find her?"
Jury suppressed a most unjury-like impulse to reply, "With a magnet." Or possibly, "I followed the trail of dismembered bodies and the terrifying shrieks of the doomed." Instead, replying simply, "I enjoy her company."
"Why is that?"
Jury smiled almost imperceptibly, a Vulcan's smile, and replied pleasantly, "She doesn't ask a lot of irritating questions."
Something very unpleasant had happened to the mind of the handsome, slightly cynical-looking young man named Koichi Sionji at one time. Even Miss Leclerc's rather limited powers and rather cursory examination could tell her that. It was a rather frightening experience. Not that the boy was mad, but it was clear that he had been once, and not because of any innate flaw. To Martine Leclerc it appeared that he had been driven mad, possibly by a telepathic attack, at some time in the fairly recent past. He still possessed a disturbing edge, not madness, but its close cousin. Possibly because of his prior experiences, he felt it when she scanned him, just as Caitlin had. Up until then, he had been, like the others, pleasant, polite, and completely unhelpful. At that instant, though, he changed. His pupils shrank, the lines of his lean face hardened, and he stopped talking in the middle of a sentence. For a moment he regarded her dispassionately, with eyes gone suddenly dead. Then he slowly unfolded from the chair, leaned forward, braced his knuckles against the top of her data desk, and bored into Miss Leclerc's eyes with his cold green gaze. When he spoke, his voice was barely above a whisper, but the menace it carried chilled her far more effectively than any shout.
"You don't want to see what's inside my head, Miss Leclerc," he said.
Then he rose to his full height and glared coldly down at her for a second before recovering his sword from under the chair, turning on his heel, and marching from the room. Martine Leclerc let out her breath in a long, shuddery sigh.
"Scratch that one," she thought. "And thank God, too. I wouldn't like to think about trying to bring him in."
Friday morning, it was Dorothy's turn. "I understand you belong to Caitlin Hutchins's brother," said Miss Leclerc as an opener.
"Yes," Dorothy replied.
"What made him send you here?"
"Love," said Dorothy flatly.
"I beg your pardon?"
"Love," replied Dorothy in precisely the same tone.
"Whose love?"
"Corwin's."
"Could you elaborate on that a bit? I'm afraid I don't understand."
"I don't think so," said Dorothy.
Miss Leclerc sighed inside. Interviewing a robot, she'd be asked to interrogate a toaster next.
"Let's try it from a different angle," she suggested. "What is Corwin hoping to gain by sending you here?"
"Gain? Nothing. In fact, he stands to lose 1.3 million credits worth of cybernetic equipment, as well as a useful servant."
"Really? Then why?"
"That is an extremely complex question," Dorothy replied. "I am only a robot. I don't feel qualified to explain concepts as complex and mutable as a man's love for a friend."
"Have you had any difficulties adjusting to your new situation?"
"None internal."
"I beg your pardon?"
"What difficulties I've had stemmed primarily from the small-minded bigotry of the central doctrines of the Galactic Church of Man," said Dorothy didactically, "as expressed in the actions and words of Professor Aaron Harris."
Miss Leclerc smiled indulgently. "Religious tolerance," she began, but Dorothy interrupted her in the same flat tone she had been using all along. "After much consideration," she said, "I have decided to tolerate only those religions which do not label me an abomination before a nebulous deity and call for my destruction." For a moment, Miss Leclerc could have sworn there was a note of wry humor in the robot's uninflected voice, a faint smirk on the plasticine features of her face, but it must have been a trick of the light. There was nothing there. "If Corwin Hutchins thinks this thing is going to pass Turing," she mused to herself, extrapolating his name logically, if incorrectly, "he's an idiot." "How'd it go?" Mia Ausa asked Dorothy as the robot emerged from Miss Leclerc's office and shut the door behind her. "I'm next." "You'll have no difficulty," Dorothy replied flatly. "The woman is an idiot." Mia's experience with Miss Leclerc seemed to bear out Dorothy's assessment, at least the second half. As the normally mild-mannered girl walked down the hill toward Galaxy House, she was almost quivering with rage, her fists clenched at her sides. She walked up the walk, mounted the stoop, used her key on the door, and entered, still fuming, to see Jacron and Miki Kaworu craning their necks curiously from a couple of the chairs in the living room.
"Ah, Miss Ausa," said Jacron warmly.
He checked his watch, then looked surprised.
"You're back early. How was your session?"
The Narn's voice trailed off as he noticed the fury blazing in Mia's dark eyes. For an instant, he scoured his mental database in a frantic search for anything he might have done or said to make her so angry at him, until he realized she wasn't looking at him, her eyes just happened to be pointed in his direction. Suddenly, the pale-faced girl whirled, seized the edge of the door, and slammed it shut with all the strength in her body, screaming as she did so,
"Dashtai!"
The window set into the middle of the door shattered, exploding outward to scatter shards of glass on the front porch and down the steps, almost reaching the sidewalk.
"That bad, eh?" Jacron murmured.
As though the act of slamming the door had broken free some reservoir inside her, Mia whirled again, now as animated with outrage as she had been stiff with it moments before.
"I cannot believe that woman calls herself a counselor," she snarled, storming into the living room. "She's rude, supercilious, pompous, insincere."
Jacron got to his feet and nodded.
"I have heard much the same from everyone who has met with her so far," he said.
"Oh, it's all true, Jacron, every word of it and more."
Mia screwed up her normally pretty face into a mocking imitation of Martine Leclerc's concerned face.
"Oh, my dear, I see by your files that you've been exiled from your homeworld. That must have been terribly traumatic for you. How are you holding up?"
"I wasn't exiled from Minbar. I left. I had to fight, to be allowed to leave."
"It must be terribly hard being unique." "Is it? You tell me, lady. Last time I checked, all sentient beings are unique."
"Growing up parentless, with no one to show you your way..." "I can find my own way, thank you very much, and I have a perfectly good parent, by the way. My father is alive and well and living in Australia. I talk to him every week. Cast aside by your family, indeed. I'd like to see her say that to Uncle Dave's face."
Mia clenched her fists and shook herself, as if trying to wring the rage out of her body.
"Oh, in Phelan's name, what an infuriating woman!"
Jacron nodded again in sad, disgruntled agreement.
"Honestly, I'm starting to believe that this institution is entering a state of severe decline. Professor Harris runs roughshod over poor Miss Wainwright.
I arrived to find that a half-dozen worlds have pulled out their students," said Mia, taking up the thread of complaint.
"Miss Broadbank's tawdry rag is allowed to continue its xenophobic slanders unchecked by the administration.
The drama club is trying to throw the duelists out of Alden Memorial.
The food has suffered a marked drop in quality, which is shocking when you consider that such a thing was not believed possible prior to this half year. The boys' basketball team goes 0-25.
They spoke the next part in eerie unison.
And now they retire poor Mr. Hanley and foist this maddening excuse for a counselor on us.
Her anger spent, Mia spun away from the tirade with a disgusted, hissing sigh and threw herself down into the end of the couch. Jacron, however, still had some dudgeon left, and it was with an irritated grunt that he glanced at his watch again.
And now I have to go and see her, he grumbled.
He placed his fists to his chest and gave a little narn bow to Mia.
I hope the rest of your day is better, he said, then turned and left.
Mia got up and followed him to the door, and Miki, intrigued by the whole proceeding, followed her. He slammed it behind him, dislodging the last of the jagged glass in the window hole to tinkle down onto the welcome mat.
"Hm," said Mia, irritated with herself for breaking it.
She held her hand up, palm outward, where the window belonged, then closed her eyes and began speaking in a curiously stilted language. Miki had heard her speaking Minbari during a few short religious observances she'd made in her room. He didn't think it was what she was speaking now, but he didn't recognize it either. With a musical sound and a scarlet shimmering, the shattered pieces of the window picked themselves up and rearranged themselves into their proper shape. There was a sound like a glass bell being struck. The red light rayed outward and was gone, and the window was whole again. Miki blinked at Mia in undisguised amazement. Noting it, she smiled for the first time since returning home. Growing up in an ancient library, she told him, has its advantages.
I guess so, he replied. That was like the thing you did to Skaya during your duel.
Sort of. A different school of sorcery, but sorcery all the same. She cocked her head inquisitively. You don't seem very shocked. He smiled. I'm not very, he said. Sorcery isn't unknown where I come from. Rare, but not relegated strictly to myth, as it seems to be in this world.
Modern society has blinkered to the power of its past, Mia observed as they returned to the living room. Technology makes magic seem inconsequential. Unnecessary.
She sat down on the couch, picked up the remote control, and switched on the television.
Like that. In a suitably primitive world, this, she waggled the remote, would be magic.
Miki would have liked to discuss that with her further. A lot further. But the program starting was her favorite show, the only thing she ever used the television for, and so he sat down at the other end of the couch, piped down, and watched it with her.
Good afternoon, said the pleasant-faced, bespectacled, blue-haired young man on the television screen, his face bracketed by Network News identigraphics. I'm speaking to you live and direct from Proxima Centauri II, where the Civil War is in its fifth bloody week. Sparked by the massive crackdown that began in the wake of the Psionics Act extension's passage, this conflict now rages out of control, a struggle about a great deal more than the lives and freedom of 10,000 telepaths. Behind the speaker, there was the snapping bark of an artillery-grade plasma cannon, and something, perhaps an armored personnel carrier, it was hard to tell in the darkness and flames, exploded. The man barely flinched, only ducking a little involuntarily, and his voice was steady as he continued, It has become a battle for the soul of Proxima itself, a fractal close-up of the problems that threaten to divide the entire United Federation of Planets against itself. For the next hour, we'll explore the causes and the consequences of this terrible conflict. I'm John Trussell, and this is Network 23. As the Network 23 News with John Trussell music and graphic blazed across the screen, Miki glanced over at Mia. Her face was white and drawn again, this time out of something far different from anger. Without looking at him, she reached out and seized his hand in an almost painful grip. He was a little surprised by that, but didn't pull his hand away. Indeed, he moved closer to her, lending his support in as quiet and unaggressive a manner as possible. She had every right to be terrified. The man standing in front of the burning APC and commentating so calmly on the violent chaos all around him was her father, after all. Janice Barlow was running a little late as she arrived on the second floor of Boynton Hall, but as she drew near the counselor's office, she realized it didn't matter. The door to the office was standing open, but there was still someone blocking the way through it. A broad-shouldered, stocky form Janice was more accustomed to seeing at the first base bag on the Institute's baseball diamond. That form's deep, resonant voice boomed through the second floor of the admin building like a foghorn. "Regret that I have such limited time, for the causes of my discontent are legion. However, courtesy demands that I stick to the assigned schedule and free you to continue your systematic irritation of each and every member of the student body in turn. You will forgive me, I hope, if I do not wish you success in this somewhat dubious cause, but insofar as it can be hoped for without that limiting factor, I do yet wish you, madam, good day." Turning, Jacron swept down the hall like a small steam locomotive building up its momentum on the way out of the station. "You tell her, big guy," said Janice with some amusement. "Impossible, woman! Everything they say is true," he grumbled as he passed. "Good day, Miss Barlow." Janice watched him disappear into the stairwell, chuckled, and went to keep her own appointment. There was a rumor going around that the new counselor was a telepath who was scanning people illegally during their interview sessions with her. Janice figured she could probably have some fun with that if she played it right. Things quieted down over the next few weeks. D-term trundled along. The Civil War in Proxima Centauri ended in its sixth week. Ended, to the surprise of no one, with the utter defeat of the rebels and the re-establishment of Earth Alliance governance. It was ironic, somehow, that Earth's oldest extrasolar colony remained a colony 3 centuries after the first of her sister colonies, Tomodachi, won her independence. Her very proximity to the homeworld meant that liberty eluded Proxima, as it did Epsilon Indi, Tau Ceti, Captain Star, Barnard Star. None of the others had tried to revolt, and they probably wouldn't now that they'd seen what happened to Proxima. Caitlin, musing over all this in Galactic History 204 one day, noted to herself that, for all that Worcester continued to be quiet and peaceful, the Earth Alliance was starting to get a little rough around the edges. The United Federation of Planets Security Council had lodged a formal censure of the EA for its handling of the Proxima Centauri incident, and had been quite firmly told to mind its own damn business. Once again, the Federation had backed away from a confrontation with its own strongest member. Devlin Carter's disgust as he read the item out of the Telegram and Gazette the next morning was almost palpable. Still, in D-term, who had time for petty stuff like the governance of the galaxy? The school year was charging toward its end, preparations had to be made for the most arduous finals of all, and the spring activities were in full swing. There were intramural baseball games to be played. True to Caitlin's prediction on Christmas, they now did have enough people for a squad. Sionji proved his courage by volunteering to catch for the pitcher opposing team soon nicknamed Fireball Tenjo. There was one more Art of Noise show at the WAG. There were tests. And, of course, there was Utrina's rather alarming independent study project for her introductory Klingonese class. This involved a rose duel against, of all people, Professor Krog, who looked somewhat out of place with a pink rose pinned to the breastplate of his armor. This contest, waged on the quad in the early afternoon, drew the biggest crowd of any duelist event yet, including the first one. The Klingon teacher was almost as popular as Utrina. Jacron, representing the Institute's official baseball team, grumbled that no one ever cheered for them that loudly, as the pink-haired, black-clad girl and her towering gray-armored foe clashed back and forth, Thorn of the Rose and Batleth glittering and sparkling in the sunlight. The look on Krolg's face when Utina's final strike blistered the air between them and showered him in the wreckage of his own rose reminded Caitlin amusingly of the expression on her father's face when he'd found himself at the bottom of his koi pond on the day after Christmas. With that one act, Utina ensured that, whatever happened during finals, there was at least one course on her D-term schedule she would ace. It also looked as though Miss Montaigne might have found her permanent replacement as the Society's faculty advisor, much to the overworked administrator's delight.